I'm John Miglosh for the WDMA. And tomorrow we're having a meetup in honor of Groundhog Day. And somebody wrote me and said, Sam wrote and said, Groundhog Day is Sunday. I know Groundhog Day is Sunday, but we're talking about the predictions of Groundhog Day. Actually, we're going to talk just about prediction and predictive modeling and direct mail. That's what we're going to do today. I want to put out this video both to invite you, 3 o'clock Thursday afternoon, Chicago time, and there's an event on the WDMA LinkedIn group and also the National Mail Order Association and a couple other places. You can also write me. The link is floating around, so you can come over and join us at 3 p.m. and love to have you. Love to get some feedback on some of the crazy opinions I've got so far about why mail and why we have such a great opportunity to help the USPS with our crazy mail. Okay, so let's dig in. Why do we model? Why do we model anyway? Right? You know, everybody thinks that modeling is about tweaking the mailing. Okay, I'm talking about in mailing or whatever. You know, and my experience is that it can do that. But I would say 80-90% of the models that I hear about, the client doesn't even know what key variables are identified. And I would contend that the main purpose is identifying causal variables, right? And I'll explain that in a minute. This is probably the most important slide right off the bat. Why do we model? Because science and engineering have predictive force to the extent that they can isolate, identify, and validate causal forces. So we know the acceleration of gravity, right? We know how much pull gravity has, and that's how we build buildings. We know that they have to withstand the force of gravity, the force of wind. We know most of the causal factors. In some places, we build them for earthquakes, although I saw since 1921 there hasn't been one earthquake, or significant earthquake anyway, in the state of Wisconsin. So it's not a variable here that you have to worry about. Snow load, that's a big variable here, okay? Yeah. That's probably one of the biggest variables, is if you get enough snow on the roof, will the roof fall in, right? But it's not a variable too much, you know, in Phoenix or in Miami, right? There you got to deal with hurricanes. So these causal forces give us the predictive capability to build stuff that works. We don't measure the number of witches per capita in a zip code because we don't think that's a causal factor. Could be. I'm not saying it isn't, right? I'm not saying it. The full moon isn't a factor in the stability of buildings. But in general, we've identified the big lumps in the soup. And part of the way we do that is by building A versus building B, seeing them next to each other in the same environment and which one falls down and figuring that out and then going into testing and seeing if the materials were poorly constructed or the construction methods. I remember a hurricane came through in Florida and a lot of the new construction, the roofs just blew off. And it turned out that they weren't inspecting the buildings well enough and they weren't fastening the roofs to the walls. And so they got on that and they stopped it. Now that doesn't happen so much, right? And, you know, in California, there's places where, like San Francisco, in this great San Francisco earthquake, about 90% of the destruction was caused by fire, not by the earthquake. And so they actually have a system where they have special fire hydrants that pull seawater in, right? So no matter what, they have enough. Now, it's expensive to build, but it could come in handy, you know, as we see. So there are causal factors which predict potential disasters. And to the extent that we can identify those and test those with repeatable effects, we will have causal variables, and to that extent, we get predictive modeling. Okay? And we do it all through life. That's what science and engineering are about. But in marketing, it's really tricky. Okay? And we'll explain why. It's not impossible, but it's tricky. And my experience working with lots of CFOs and CEOs and owner, operators, and presidents of companies is that they're looking for that kind of information. They're looking for what can we know about the customer for sure? You know, where if we take customer group A versus B, we can judge the impact of whatever that difference is. Now, that requires the kind of experiment that we do in science. But that isn't generally the way marketing is done. There might be some testing. There might be some test markets, you know, but oftentimes it's very difficult, especially if you're using media. You know, you could put billboards in one town and not billboards in another, but there's a lot of things that can also be going on and affect that test, right? It's hard to do tests in mass media, especially in TV or digital. You know, there's some really good things that can happen, but there's also a lot of other factors that can happen. They're looking for a known return on investment. Bob Meyer, my old mentor at the ad agency, said what owners of companies are looking for, and then what we were looking for was we're looking for a box where you put in a dollar and out jumps $1.50 or $2. How many dollars would you put into that box if you knew that $2 would jump back out? And the answer is as many as you could find, right? That's the goal. That's what the CFO wants. You say, well, they won't give me any budget. That's because they don't believe you. It's as simple as that. You know, when they do the cost analysis of a new machine tool, they say, well, if we get, you know, this one machine is holding up our production. And if we buy this machine, we can get 10% better throughput. Okay, what's that worth, that 10%? What does the machine cost? How long will it take to pay off that machine based on that extra throughput? You know, with some other you know, considerations taken into account. That's the kind of thing that we need to aim for in our marketing. That's what predictive modeling should get us, if there really were such a thing. And to the extent that it's provable and the variables are isolated, identified, and validated, we get more budget. And I've regularly gotten more budget. You know, I was just messaging with Andrew Ettinger. He's one of the few people I know in the whole world that is regularly siphoning off digital budgets to pay for more mail. So he's the kind of guy you want to listen to. Very, very much so. And what he's doing is, you know, sort of the basics of what we were doing in the 80s. But he's just doing it consistently, and he won't take clients that won't do it. And that's the kind of courage we need. Instead of just saying, oh, let's do some mail. Okay, we'll mail some stuff. That will not cut it. You have to say no to mail if they're not going to do the disciplines. So here we go. You know, back a few years ago, I was speaking for the U.S. Postal Service, and I ran across these statistics. I think it was from Gartner Group that said 85% of AI projects fail. I haven't seen that repeated too many times since, but I haven't seen too many success stories either of AI. And I think part of it's because they don't know what they're looking for. And part of it's because they can't get the data they need to make it work. We're going to talk about that. Okay, one of the challenges is that the computer will see patterns, but most of that is spurious. And I've talked on this many, many times. But the bigger your data, the more likely the identified variables are crazy things. So with big mailers, you know, sometimes we'll find a variable like the percentage, across the whole country with a million piece mailing or something, we'll find a variable like The number of disabled veterans above age 85 in a zip code, or the percentage of disabled 85-year-old veterans. Okay, that's a minuscule percentage of the population. It can't possibly be a real factor. We throw those in anyway just to see what happens. I would say about 80% of my work as a modeler was throwing out the spurious correlations that my machine learning spotted. Now, fortunately, my machine learning tools had given me the opportunity to see the variables. You know, so often the neural net, the sorts of things that they use today, not even the operators know what's really going on in there. Okay? And so you need to push for those variables. You need to identify, and to do that, you need a specific kind of information. It's called a labeled data set. Okay? So when they tried to teach Watson how to play Jeopardy over at IBM, they had a set of 127,000 old Jeopardy questions. They knew the right answers. They knew the wrong answers. Both are important. Got to have A and B, or A and not A. And they would do their algorithm, and then they would launch it, and they would see how Watson did on Jeopardy questions, on real Jeopardy questions built by humans. And they got better and better at tuning their algorithm, because they would look at the ones that Watson got wrong. And that is the sort of thing that we need. You've probably seen something like this. Select all the squares with traffic lights. And, obviously, here's traffic lights. They have little lights on them. Here's another set over here. And those might be spottable by AI, if they've had enough training in what traffic lights look like. The tricky part is these guys. These do not look like traffic lights. They look like boxes with no lights, right? But a human knows that. A human knows that these are traffic lights facing the wrong way. Now, AI, if left to its own, will eliminate the outliers. These are outliers. And even worse, if you let AI train on AI-built data sets or pictures, it will consistently remove more and more and get down to the essence of traffic light, which will be these guys. But if you're coming up in a car, a self-driving car, behind a little box truck, the first lights you'll see are these. But you say, oh, that's not, those aren't stoplights. You know, they've had problems with the self-driving cars. If somebody puts a little sticker on a stop sign, it says, well, that's not a stop sign. That looks very different than a real stop sign. And it goes right through. Maybe kills somebody. Okay, and this is why humans, which are really good at this, are important to make your labeled data set. Okay, because humans can identify all this stuff, right? But not necessarily the AI, because it will eliminate things that aren't so obvious, like this one. It's a traffic light, but it's the wrong side of a traffic light. It's facing the opposite way. Okay. So for AI to work in marketing, we need this labeled data set to train on. Where do we get it? Well, direct mail has a clear advantage, because we know who we mailed. We know it got delivered. We know it went to a decision maker, because you don't let your kids go get the mail and throw the mail and decide what mail to throw away. We know there was engagement, because mail has 10 times the tactile, has 10 times the neural receptors that vision does. So you have to engage in it, even if it's just touching it, even if it's just throwing it away. It's still 10 times more impactful than is a visual, just a pure visual. Okay? We know that a decision is made, that you have to decide whether you're going to buy, save it for later, or toss it. So we know who bought. Of course, most media knows that. You do a special, you send out a coupon or something, and people bring it into the store. You know who engaged and redeemed it or bought. What you don't know is who looked at that. Maybe it's only visual. Who looked at it, engaged, and decided not to buy. And that is the comparison we're looking for to identify those causal variables, to build the observations and then the testing to isolate and identify and verify those causal factors, the differences between population A and population B that didn't buy or not A. Okay? The engaged and did not buy are the puzzle. That's the puzzle. And the problem is, you know, let's say we put up that billboard. And, you know, it's for $1 hot dogs, next exit. You can talk to the people that come in and buy a $1 hot dog. What you can't figure out is how many people who drove by the billboard. And even if you knew everybody that drove by, you still don't know who was paying attention, who was looking at their speedometer, who was yelling at the kids in the back seat and would have liked those hot dogs, but didn't engage at all. Didn't even see it, right? And that's the problem with media. Media throws itself away. Think about that. Every medium you ignore throws itself away, except mail. Mail, you have to engage. And that gives us the other side of the labeled data set. The engaged non-buyers, which allows us to isolate the causal variables. So, mail advantages, your brain has 10 times more touch than vision processing. You have to engage with mail. In the 50s, or in the 80s rather, when I got started, only about 50% of households did remote buying, so they pretty much could throw their mail away without even looking at it. But now, nearly 100% of households have credit cards, nearly 100% of them buy something online, buy something with a credit card, and the mailbox is less full, the readership for mail is up. It's really the golden age of mail. Not only that, but if you think about it a little bit, and it wasn't from Ad Age, but it was from a big advertising magazine. They said for a local business like a florist, they were paying about $5 per click to their website, okay, from Google. For those clicks, it was about half of those people that came didn't go any further, just left, clicked on nothing. That's called the bounce, okay? And Google says their bounce rate is about 50%, which means that that engagement costs $10 per click, per person engaged at the site. You see that? Right? And you say, well, I'll have a landing page for the offer, and then that'll be better, but actually it's worse. The more specific the offer, the less it applies to everybody. So more people leave and go away. Okay? Now, what I understand is that, and so if you have a landing page, it's about $20. But let's just stick with the $10. Okay? Now, mail, on the other hand, you know, you can do lots of nice mail for a dollar per piece. You know, you can do a nice postcard. You can do probably even a nice little number 10 with something simple in it. You know, there's a lot of formats that are in that neighborhood. And if you have long runs, you know, up until 2 years ago, 3 years ago, well, maybe it's a little longer now. My last catalog clients were down in the 70 cent range per 48 page catalogs, but they were printing a lot. Okay. We'll give it a bounce rate of 15%, meaning that they throw them right in the trash. But, you know, whatever you mail, you know, we use a standard rule of thumb, 2% to consumer mailings and maybe 0.5% to business, but the average order is generally higher. So the engagement, the standard engagement, is about 1/10 the cost of the pay-per-click. And after that, you might get the same amount of response. That's what I'm told. You can fight with these, but I've been using this example for several years, and everybody kind of nods. And it doesn't mean digital doesn't work. It just means that mail could be considerably less expensive. The tricky part is, and we learned this way back You know, I was teaching USPS salespeople about direct mail. And somebody came up to me at the break and said, why would anybody pay $500 a thousand? That's when it was 50 cents to put a catalog in the mail or something. I would use 50 cents. And that's not too bad, you know, just a double in price considering that was in the 90s. So that was 30 years ago. But anyway, at the class, they said, why would anybody spend $50 a thousand to reach an audience when they could reach an audience for $20 a thousand with TV? And I hope I explained it. And we ended up selling a lot of direct mail tests with a lot of big brands and national advertisers. Okay? But all of my career, it was mail versus other advertising channels, right? And then mail versus the internet. Okay? And so what I learned early on was if you do not verify mail, it just looks expensive and difficult. It's easier to shoot one TV commercial, and you can sometimes get that to work for years, than it is to do a different mailing every couple of months, you know, or a 48 or a 64 or a 500-page catalog. But it is possible to verify mail. That's been my entire career, has been verifying, validating the return on investment of mail. And Paul Lawson, Paul the printer I call him, down in Arizona, sent me a USPS email. Great. Just yesterday, saying that 67% of brand advertisers say that mail is their best ROI. Okay? Remember, we know who we mailed, we know it gets to the household, we know it gets to a decision maker, we know there is engagement, we know you have to make a decision, and we know the engaged non-buyers. The labeled data set is guaranteed. It's built right in. So mail solves this puzzle of machine learning. And I would contend any decent-sized advertiser should be using mail at least as a laboratory to verify and validate their customer knowledge. Okay? Not only that, but I have a track record, and I know a lot of people who do, like Andrew Ettinger, which I just got a message from, like Musician's Friend. I learned about this from Musician's Friend because they were owned by Guitar Center, and Guitar Center wasn't too happy that there was a... I mean, a lot of the people that I knew at Guitar Center weren't too happy that there was a direct mail competitor, even if they owned it. You know, they seemed to think that any guitar that sold through the catalog was a robbery of the store. Well, you know, and obviously that it wasn't the case. But anyway, so then Guitar Center was owned by an investment group in Dubai, I think. I met with one of the representatives of that investment group one time. And he said, we don't have a mail, you know, mail culture, and we don't understand why you spend $10 million a year or whatever it was on mailing these catalogs. Well, it was generating like $500 million in gross sales. Sounds like a good deal, right? Anyway, so they had us test a lot, and this is what I learned, is that you could take your... We were usually mailing about 500,000 pieces at a time. And what we would do is we would carefully select about 30,000 that we weren't going to mail and see how they did, see how both groups, A and B, how both groups did, the mail and the not mail, downstream in the next month or two. And what we found was that the mailed group did $22 in downstream profit per customer, and the not mail did 12, because, you know, by then this was in the mid teens, and by then there were, you know, lots of websites and email marketing and all kinds of stuff. They had everything that you have to this day, you know. They didn't have TikTok, but they had Facebook and they had Google. So significant difference in the group that got mail versus the group that got no mail. And there were a couple that we held out for 3 months. So 10,000 of that 30,000, there was a 10,000 sample that got no catalog. for 3 whole months, and there was even a greater difference in that differential. See? And that's bottom line profit. We found hundreds of percent of return on investment on the cost of that catalog. And we had to prove it year after year after year, right? I also recently, just in the last few months, worked with a medical provider, and we found that the not mailed produced, and this is mainly lead generation, but the percentage of impact was double the ones that got mailed versus the ones that didn't, that we held out, even though we had equal digital, social, out of home, and event exposure. You know, that we left that all run. We didn't stop that. But we could hold out the mail because of some of these intrinsic qualities of direct mail. So direct mail with direct marketing methods can isolate the causal variables. And what's the key to predictive modeling? It's really isolating those causal variables. What's the difference between the people who engaged and bought versus the people who engaged and didn't buy? That's the key information that we need for a model. And that's missing with media. And it's missing with digital. Right? And that is important to keep in mind. So, off we go. Let's go a little further. Conclusion. I wonder why direct mail marketing always seemed to beat mass media. This was something that puzzled me after giving these training talks in 2018. How could I do the modeling if 85% of AI fails? And it's because mail had a built-in labeled data set. Let's talk just a few case studies. Eric Nordstrom said, results were hurt by stopping their use of mail. Linda Heasley, who's no longer there, said we planned some shift from direct mail. We moved too much too soon. Direct mail works. We can prove it. With Musician's Friend, we had 11 head-to-head modeling tests with six different modeling companies over 6 years, 500,000 in each test, and it was a 64-page catalog, so it wasn't trivial. Okay, and here's the modelers. With Bullock and Jones, the Uniques test, which is another way to test the differences between models especially, the client's model pulled $1.30 per book. Our model, the Uniques, the ones we pulled that they had ignored, right, pulled $15. The ones that we ignored pulled $1.50. Musician's Friend found that too. They said, when we went against UCLA and the Guitar Center people, they said that our Uniques beat theirs by 321%, and the professors at UCLA said that was impossible. That couldn't possibly be true. We must have cheated. That's what that letter says. Okay, in PetEdge, we found a whole new market. We found a whole new market that was probably 5 times bigger than what they've been marketing to for the last, 20, 30 years, right? And all of a sudden, they grew 20% 1 year just from identifying the unique characteristics in those engaged versus non-engaged buyers. Okay, Lovesac is a more recent example. Okay, we worked with Lovesac from 2014 into 2017, and they grew 50% or 33% in 1 year, and they're a 25-30-year-old company. I'm not going to get into all that. It was one of the worst possible mail applications because it's a high ticket item that you don't repeat buy. But we did these holdout tests. Because their VP of marketing, I think he was calling me to cancel my project. He said, why should we mail to people who already know our product when our biggest problem seems to be that people don't know our product? And I said, that's one of the best questions I've ever been asked. Would you like to know the answer? He said, how could you know the answer? And I explained to him about Musician's Friend and about these holdout tests so we can know for sure. And it turned out we had a 300% EBITDA ROI. So every dollar that we put into that box, $3 jumped out, right? Or $2 more, but $3 total jumped out. He said, maybe we should keep doing that. And then we noticed a peculiar thing on our matchback analysis, that we noticed that there were, for every one order that matched exactly a customer, where they literally reordered, we found two near neighbors that ordered significantly more money. And that gave us a 900% EBITDA ROI. Well, they're mailing to this day, right? So we taught them about testing offers. We taught them about a lot of things. And then they use that in their TV and in their other marketing, on their website, and all of their other marketing. What we taught them from mail and the testing and the knowing something for sure about their offer, for sure about their customers, they took that, used it to pour gasoline on all their marketing, other marketing efforts. And that's how we got startling growth, and they went public. So, what time is it? It's the golden age. It's the golden age of predictive modeling and of direct mail. You may not realize it, but that's true. So, what does this have to do with USPS? I want to help. If you've been here this long, I want you to click like or give me a comment or something. But this is from the Office of the Inspector General at USPS from just September 2024, just recently. They don't put up much. They don't do much that fast. Okay? And what they were saying was declining marketing volume reduces the mail density and therefore makes mail delivery increasingly less profitable per address served. As each delivery point becomes less profitable, the delivery network becomes more difficult to sustain. I'm surprised USPS even realizes this, that the decline of marketing mail, which this is specifically talking about, is part of the reasons why the post office has a deficit. Okay? I did this graph myself from postal service data that I found. It was not easy. I had to key all these numbers in myself. Everyone had made this chart. And what it shows is that it shows mail declining. It shows first class declining much faster, right? And it shows the employees. But what it shows is that the employees have not declined at the same rate that the mail has declined, which suggests to me that there's significant upside capacity, at least to this level, right? Where we should be able to go from here back to here. Okay? And if we did, if we increased the marketing mail, we would impact the Postal Service by between $10 and $14 billion of extra revenue. And this is what, that's not even what we had in 2008. So what happened to it? Well, mostly what happened to it is the digital lies. People have been lied to, and nobody is getting educated in direct mail, much less direct mail marketing. You know, I gave a talk on this in Minnesota, and most of the people were graduate students or had graduate MBAs in marketing. And one person came up to me afterwards and said, you know, in all of my marketing classes, including my MBA, we didn't have one lecture on mail. Not one lecture, much less a course. They have no idea how this stuff is not only possible, but how to do it. Time's running out. Us old guys are getting older. We need to get this case out there and made. And that's why I thank my supporters for funding the WDMA to some extent. So I'm working on how to propose this to the USPS. Okay? Because I know that increased marketing mail also increases first-class mail. None of my mailers who started doing mail started with first class. It's even more expensive, right? They started with marketing mail, but when we found out that that was working and we split tested first class, oftentimes first class won, right? So first class can be impacted and increased, right? And it's the pre-sort that has the most upside potential, because that's some of the most profitable mail in the Postal Service, right? And it's the easiest to handle. It gets delivered to the post office. It's unbelievable. The mailers do the work. So there's not the increased overhead of packages or of random mail, right? And if you get the retail world to see that mail is the key to driving more traffic on their website, more traffic to their stores, there's also impact to package volume, which is what the USPS is all in on for the last few years, which is, I think, insane. But anyway, we'll go on to that. So if we restore the marketing volume, it's about 10 to 14 billion in increased revenue. It makes delivery sustainable. It makes the USPS profitable with no new rate increases, just more pieces. Is that possible? I believe it is. Here's my plan. Inspire. We need people that are willing to get out there, give talks, inform the brand advertisers, the national advertisers, the ANA, about the possibilities and what mail can offer. We did this in the 90s. We got lots of tests. It's just that we didn't require that they set them up properly to actually prove the ROI on mail and compare to what the media delivers, okay? For that, you need to instruct. You need a task force of direct mail experts that know how to work with brand advertisers, with retailers, that know that this stuff is scalable. It's surprising. Even the agencies that I talk to don't really get proper feedback. So then let's increase mail. Let's incentivize doing it right instead of incentivizing a QR code. A QR code that goes to the main website that people aren't even tracking. You know, they give you a couple of percent off your postage fee. Let's give a couple of percent to the mailers that are willing to participate in case studies. And let's have assurance that the case studies are built properly so that we case after case after case prove the value of mail. You'll have a stampede to mail like I saw in the early 80s. Everybody wanted to do it. Everybody wanted to try it. It's not that hard. We just have to do it well. So why mail? It's built in for predictive modeling. It's what everybody wants to get figured out. And it's capable of saving USPS. I welcome your comments. If you have any ideas more on how to sell mail, I'm open to them. We may have a way to even get this in front of people that matter. Have a great day. Like and share. Bye-bye.